Blog Talk Radio.
Summer before we hit the autumnal equinox, the 22nd of September. Paul, world in balance again. Welcome to Sonic Effects, where we contribute to the dialogue, to that never-ending conversation that started so very long ago between men who had stopped to pause and reflect on the world around them and themselves, apparently. I hope you've been well for the next while. I think you'll find the program today particularly interesting. We've got a commentary when we were of kings and geniuses, and I think it really speaks to the idea of the process of change that is of our history. What are the influences that change our history? And as odd as that sounds, it's meant literally. How can things that have happened in the past that are defined begin to change you? You might ask. A massive universe in a constant state of flux, influenced by forces and things that we understand and recognize and can measure, and things that we can only speculate and theorize about. And yet this notion that humans have developed is very unique. We can stop. We can not want change. Isn't that an interesting effect of the process of having a consciousness? We don't yet know whether we're other animals, other forms of life have formed consciousness. So up to this point, we assume that we are unique in that way. It gives us a special perspective if we are that unique. But to think that out of that consciousness comes a sense of a disdain, of a discomfort with change, is then all the more unique and remarkable. How in the world could that ever possibly happen? Our consciousness and awareness tells us that men are all created equal in certain ways and are distinct and unique in other ways, including interests and talents and abilities, capacity. Only wish that we could all live as optimal people with optimal intelligence, whatever that might be, and the means to survive. We haven't reached that yet, and we're still wrestling with time-worn positions about the planet being too crowded and our inability to, the myth of our inability to feed everybody on the planet. That, we have to cull the herd because we just can't feed everybody. that was a 19th century phenomenon, that theory came about. And it was not true at the time. It was not accurate at the time. And it's certainly not accurate today, but it is popular. Right up against Flat Earth Society, walking with dinosaurs, and the Earth being the center of the universe. How ridiculous. We know that each one of us is the center of the universe. We're going to start the show off with a little soft music. Get us all in the mood while you grab a cup of your favorite beverage and hunker in to what I hope will be an hour of interesting conversation and good question. Here's an old standard, make someone happy. It's what we do. Their attention, I think. What an interesting order what an interesting order is masonry. History of masonry encompasses the origins and evolution and defining events of a fraternal order. It was first the emergence of organized lodges of operative Masons during the Middle Ages, and then the admission of lay members as accepted or speculative Masons. Finally, the evolution of purely speculative lodges, the emergence of grand lodges to govern them. That's where our constitutions were developed. Much earlier, though, 14th century, in Holland, the constitution was formed for guilds. It offers us the protection, many protections. The watershed, and some watershed moments. And let's not get into the controversy of the new history, the new findings about this. But let's assume that the Grand Lodge in London in 1717 was the first of its sort. I am not able to anymore to say that and discount the development history of masonry in Scotland. Regardless, the facts are there and evidence-based being what it is. So writing a complete history of masonry is really difficult. I don't think it's possible within a single article. It's just too much. But there's a great mystery and a romanticism about the start of masonry. We find the earliest Masonic texts contain some sort of history of the craft or mystery, like the Halliwell manuscript or the Giles poem. Those are dating around 1390 and 1425 at Halliwell. So, you know, 14th and 15th century. And they just contain a little history in the introduction. Like that the craft of masonry began with Euclid in Egypt and came to England in the reign of King Athelstan. And then the Cook manuscript a little bit later traces the masonry to Jabal, the son of Lamech. And you can find those references in Genesis 4, verses 20 to 22. And this tells how this knowledge came to Euclid, from him to the children of Israel while they were in Egypt. And that myth formed the basis for the manuscript constitutions, tracing history, tracing masonry back to biblical times and fixing its institutional establishment in England during the reign of Athelstan, 927 to 939. So myth and history, it's the best we have. Shortly after the formation of the Premier Grand Lodge of England, James Anderson, Reverend Anderson, was commissioned to pull together all these constitutions into something current. Change, yes. There were fragments of information, and the Grand Lodge was standardizing and wanted something cogent and coherent. And what the product of this was a constitution preface more extensive than anything before. And a lot of it is, if you've studied this carefully, it's fictional. He fixes the first grand assembly of English Masons at York under Athelstan's son, Edmund. And we don't know anything else about the, you know, Edmund just seems to be this little pearl in history. But then in 1738, the constitutions were revised and republished. The first set we knew went back because it was, you know, we're looking at an ecumenical approach to this fraternal order. And the first set, as you can imagine from a Presbyterian member of clergy, was really tilted towards one faith over the others. And that really didn't settle well at the time, particularly given that Britain, this is in Britain, the Civil War had ended 40 years earlier. and the Hundred Years' War history, the history of religious conflict was crushing, and not lost to any Englishman. But in France in 1737, there was a lecture of Chevalier Ramsay, and in that lecture he added the Crusaders to the lineage. 1737. So you think back at the start, we didn't have these notions of the Crusade, nothing quixotic about this. He simply stated that the Crusader Masons had revived the craft with secrets recovered in the Holy Land under the patronage of the Knights Hospitaller. So at this point, the history of craft in continental Freemasonry diverged from that in England. But Anderson's histories in 1723 and 1738, and Ramsay's romanticization, together with the internal allegory of Masonic ritual, centered on King Solomon's temple and its architecture, and its architect, Hiram Abiff. And that's provided the material for incredible speculation. Grant me a forgiving heart. That was the request of King Solomon to the Creator, the great architect of the universe. Grant me a forgiving heart. We know him for wisdom. Maybe many of us do, but perhaps asking for a forgiving heart is a sign of some deeper wisdom than our plunge into something competitive or hubris. Now, following Ramsay's introduction of Crusader Masons, the Knights Templar became involved in the myth, starting with Karl Gotthard von Hund's ritual rite of strict observance. And that was also linked with the exiled House of Stuart. The murder of Hiram Abiff was assumed to be an allegory for the death of Charles I in England, beheaded by Parliament. And one thing led to another, as we know. Of anything, the king's indifference to the change in politics was met with a tragic end, but almost inevitable given the circumstance of the day, executing a king. Nothing had been done like that in the country before. A little reminder of the allegory of the prices we pay, willing or unwilling, for an effort to maintain a position, a false position, as it turns out. Cromwell emerged as the founder of Freemasonry in an anonymous anti-Masonic work in 1745, but commonly attributed to Abbe Lurendat. Huh. This is where Mackay states that the propositions of Lurendat are distinguished from their absolute independence of all historical authority, and the bold assumptions which were presented to the reader in the place of facts. The anti-Masonic writings of Christoph Friedrich Nicolai implicated Francis Bacon in the Rosicrucians, while Christopher Wren's connection with the craft was omitted from Anderson's first book of Constitutions, but appeared in the second when Wren was dead. The German pioneer in Masonic history, Joseph Gabriel Findel, and other saints who sought the origins of organized masonry in the lodges of the medieval German cathedrals, although no link has been found to the development of the Freemasonry that later spread from England to Germany. Similar calls to root Freemasonry in the French Campanonage have produced no concrete links. Connections to the Roman Collegia and Comencini masters are similarly tenuous, although I wrote an interesting paper on it, and if that is interesting reading. And I recommend that to him. Although some Freemasons see them as exemplars rather than ancestors. Yeah. Now, Masonic Effects, you've heard us jump into reading by Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine, American, traced Freemasonry to ancient Egypt, as did Cagliostro, who went so far as to supply the ritual. But several authors have linked the Templars to the timeline of Masonry through the imagery of the carvings in the Roslyn Chapel in Scotland, where the Templars are rumored to have sought refuge after the dissolution of the order. In the Hiram Key, Robert Lomas and Christopher Knight describe a timeline starting in ancient Egypt and taking in Jesus, the Templars, and Roslyn before arriving at modern Freemasonry. But the first rational study of Masonic history was published in Germany, George Close, in 1847. His work was never translated. Geschichte der Freemasonry in England, Ireland, and in Scotland. I'm butchering the accent, eh? When Findel's History of Freemasonry was translated in English in 1866, Woodford in England and Murray Leung in Scotland were already active writers on the subject. Woodford was Findel's guide when he visited York to inspect transcripts and would shortly collaborate with Higgins in collecting, dating, and classifying the old manuscript constitutions. Albert Mackay was no less active in America. The list of his published works starts in 1844 with a lexicon of Freemasonry and extends to his monumental Encyclopedia of Freemasonry in 1874. Interest increased and participation in Masonic studies led in 1886 to the formation in London of Corto Coronate Lodge, the first lodge dedicated to Masonic research. Excellent. Of course, we moved ahead. The earliest official English documents to refer to Masonry are written in Latin or Norman French, and they appear in London in 1212, in Oxford in 1391, and in the Statute of Laborers in 1351, so 13th century. These all signify a worker in freestone, a grainless sandstone or limestone suitable for ornamental masonry. In the 17th century building accounts of Wadham College, the terms Freemason and Freestone Mason were used interchangeably. Freemason also contrasts with rough mason or layer, as a more skilled worker or worked or laid to dress stone. The adjective free in this context may be taken to infer that the mason was not enslaved, indentured, or feudally bound. While this is difficult to reconcile with medieval English masons, it apparently became important to Scottish operative lodges. A medieval master mason would be required to undergo what passed for a liberal education in those days. In England, he would leave home at 9 or 10 years of age, already literate in English and French, educated at home or at the petty school, junior school. And then until the age of 13 or 14, he would attend monastery or grammar school to learn Latin, or as a page in a knightly household and would learn deportment in addition to his studies. Between the ages of 14 and 17, he would learn the basic skills of choosing, shaping, and combining stone, and then between the ages of 17 and 21, be required to learn by rote a large number of formal problems in geometry. 3 years as a journeyman would often finish with the submission of a masterwork dealing with a set problem in construction or design. At this point, he was considered qualified, but still had a career ladder to climb before attaining the status of master mason on a large project. in his function as architect, the master mason probably made his plans for each successive stage of a building silver point on a prepared parchment or board. These would be realized on the ground by using a larger compass than the one used for drafting. Medieval architects are depicted with much larger compasses and squares, where they are shown on a business building site. Fine detail was transferred from the drawing board by means of wooden templates applied to the masons. The master masons who appear in record as presiding over major works such as York Minster became wealthy and respected. Visiting master masons and master carpenters sat at a high table of monasteries, dining with the abbot. And from the Middle Ages to the Reformation, the historical record shows two levels of organization in medieval masonry, the lodge and the guild. The original use of the word lodge indicates a workshop erected on the site of a major work, the first mention being Vale Royal Abbey in 1278. Later, it gained the secondary meaning of the community of masons in a particular place. The earliest surviving records of these are the laws and ordinances of the Lodge at York Minster in 1352. It should be noted that these regulations were imposed by the dean and chapter of the Minster. 19th century historians imposed the term guild on the fellowships of medieval tradesmen as an analogy of the merchant guilds. So it's a convention. The Masons were late in forming such bodies. The major employer of Masons in medieval England was the Crown, and the Crown frequently employed Masons by impressment. In other words, they were forcibly recruited when the need rose. In 1356, the preamble to regulations governing the trade of Masons specifically states, unlike the other trades, no body existed for the regulation of Masonry by Masons. Finally, in 1376, four representatives of the mystery or trade are elected to the Common Council in London. This also seems to be the first use of the word Freemason in England, in English. It was immediately struck out and replaced with the word Mason. The Hallowell manuscript, or Regius poem, is the oldest known document of Masonic origin. It gained the soliloquy, the Regius poem, because it was left and found in the library of the royal family. It was published in 1840 by Shakespearean scholar and collector James Hallowell, who dated it to 1390. A.F.A. Woodford, the pioneering Masonic scholar and a founder of Quarto Coronati Lodge, agreed with this dating, 1390. But more recently, historian Andrew Prescott has dated the text to the second quarter of the 15th century. The poem may be seen as a response to a stream of legislation dating back to the Black Death and the statutes of laborers in 1351. In which Edward III attempted to fix wages at pre-plague levels. The earlier date follows the 1389 ordinance of Richard II requiring the guilds and fellowships to lay before him their charters and letters patent. And the second follows the more serious legislation in 1425, banning the annual assemblies of Masons. The poem claims that these assemblies were ordained by King Athelstan and that he also linked the wages of a mason to the cost of living. The Cook manuscript, dating from about 1450, set the pattern of what Anderson called the Gothic Constitution, the older history and regulations of the craft. After a brief blessing, these documents describe the seven liberal arts, assigning predominance to geometry, which is equated with Masonry. They then proceed to a history of masonry geometry and finishing with King Athelstan or Edwin, his son or brother, depending on your source, and assembling England's masons to give them their charges. the regulations or charges follow, usually with instructions as to the manner in which a new Mason should swear to them. Also around 1450, the Will of a Mason from Beverly gives a tantalizing glimpse into the emergence of Masonic regalia. An inventory of John Gaddeby's possessions mentioned several zonas or girdles. Two were silver mounted, and one of these had the letters B and I in the middle, indicating Boaz and Jacob, the twin pillars of Solomon's temple. He also owned a writing table and six English books, making him comfortably well off and literate. The following century and a half produced few new manuscripts. The Dahlem manuscript, whose original is now lost, and Grand Lodge No. 1, for the first time, locate Edwin's Assembly of Masons at York. The Lansdowne, originally dated to this period, is now thought to be dated from the 17th century. It was during this period that the Reformation occurred. It was at one time assumed the church was the major employer of Masons, and with the dissolution of the Mason monasteries, the lodges disappeared. It was also believed the craft guilds were abolished in England in 1547. On the death of Henry VIII, Archbishop Cranmer sought to advance the Reformation by the abolition of guilds and fellowships. In 1548, the Bill of Conspiracies of Victuallers and Craftsmen was passed, evoking their monopolies. In 1549, it was repealed, presumably because they were too useful to the government. The government continued to be a major employer of Masons, whom London had moved from a fellowship to an incorporation. While this was not chartered until 1666, the state used it in the 16th century to procure and indent Masons for building projects. In addition, Masons were increasingly employed by private individuals. The Saints' Day parades by the various crafts enacting plays about their various patron saints were, however, suppressed. Robert Cooper, the archivist of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, believes that the lost mystery play of the Masons may survive in the ritual of contemporary Masonic lodges. An early continental history quotes a 16th century source that by 1535, there were two Scottish Masonic lodges recorded in France, one in Paris and the other in Lyon. At home, the lodges of Masons were brought under the control of two crown-appointed officials, the Warden General and the principal master of the work of the crown, the latter being in existence from 1538 at the latest. Toward the end of the century, William Skaw held both these posts. In 1598, in conference with the masters of lodges in southeast Scotland, he produced a set of regulations for the governance of Masons and their lodges, now known as the Skaw Statutes. These state, "They shall be true to one another and live charitably together as becometh sworn brethren and companions of the craft." They mention wardens, deacons, enter apprentices, and cowans. The second Skaw statute, a year earlier, included in the negotiations a representative of the Lodge of Kilwinning, now the Lodge Mother Kilwinning, number 0 in Ayrshire, which was assigned jurisdiction over the west of Scotland. Edinburgh became the first and principal lodge, and Kilwinning the second and head lodge of Scotland, attempting to appease all parties. Since neither the king nor the master of Kilwinning was present, the document was not regarded as final or binding. It was assumed that the king's warrant for the regulations would be obtained. In 1602, Skaw wrote a charter granting to Sir William Sinclair of Rosland the right to purchase patronage over the Masons of Scotland. Kilwinning is noticeably absent from the list of lodges appending their endorsement. The charter seems to have lapsed when Sinclair fled following a scandal. And a second charter was granted to his son, also William Sinclair, in 1628. This patronage was surrendered by their descendant, another William Sinclair, on the formation of the Grand Lodge of Scotland in 1736. In spite of that fact, that it had never won the royal approval that would have made it valid. The lasting effect of the Scots statutes arose from the 1599 directive that the lodges should employ a reputable notary as secretary, and that he should record all important transactions. The Scottish lodges began to keep minutes, and therefore the appearance of accepted or non-operative masons is better recorded than in England, where there was no known internal records of lodge proceedings. The first recorded admission of non-masons was on the 3rd July 1634 in the persons of Sir Anthony Alexander, his elder brother Lord Alexander, and Sir Alexander Strand of Thornton. Sir Anthony was the king's principal master of work and the man who had effectively blocked the second Sinclair charter, the lodges of Scotland being his own responsibility. The reasons that his brother and their friend were also admitted are unclear. The reasons and mechanisms for the transition of Masonic lodges from operative communities to speculative fellowships remains elusive, as the responsibility for design shifted from the master mason to the architect of the 16th century. It is probable that architects started to join the lodges of the masons they worked with. And it's also possible, along with other professional bodies, including the East India Company, operative Masonic lodges began to raise money by charging the gentry for admission to their mysteries. Another opinion states that Masonic lodges deliberately recruited the rich and powerful in an attempt to improve their pay and working conditions. While lodge records show a gradual development of mixed lodges in Scotland, it's evident that the lodge which initiated Elias Ashmole in Warrington on the 16th of October, 1646, was mainly or entirely composed of speculative or accepted masons. In 1686, Robert Plott's Natural History of Staffordshire contains a passage about persons of quality being admitted to the Society of Freemasons, whose history Plott finds inventive and ridiculous. At the start of Grand Lodge period, there seems to have been a predominance of purely speculative lodges in the south of England, with operative and mixed lodges still in the majority in the north and in Scotland. In 1716, four lodges and some old brothers met at the Apple Tree Tavern in Covent Garden and agreed to meet again the next year to form a Grand Lodge. These were the Goose and Gridiron, the Crown, the Apple Tree, and the Rummer and Grapes. The old brothers were probably from the Cheshire Cheese and at least one other lodge. Small, small beginnings. The history is worth a look to. We need to become capable and knowledgeable about our craft in order to be considered a thoughtful and true mason. Other than superficial, and how do we come to that conclusion? It's into the history. Note and reflect on the history we've just heard. That's a small portion. Is it relevant? Well, to come to a complete understanding of masonry, one would think an understanding of the history would create and establish added dimensions, obviously. We have work to do today, so we're going to before we get to our next portion, here's a little Mark Whitfield doing a piece called Isn't She Lovely? It's from 2009. Perhaps we have to talk surely about, you know, superiors and supernatural things within Freemasonry, but that constant appetite for mystery has taken our order in different directions over the years, and you and I have the benefit of being able to study a great deal of those journeys. A great many of those journeys in some detail, growing detail these days. This is perhaps the 21st century, is perhaps the inevitable conclusion that our ancient brethren were striving to achieve. There are those legitimately and rightfully so who want all of the notions of Freemasonry to be locked in a box. But we hear in the history, if we accept any of the history that I went through earlier, all plundered from the internet, and I think credible references to legitimize the work. Let this known makes it very clear that there has to be speculation because. About our history, because a great deal was unknown and it wasn't written down. And we have snippets. We have the illusion and reference in a great deal of inconsistency. It wasn't that we had hired notaries to write down the entire procedure. So we have to, like historians, the professional historians have done, undertake that work of searching out and piecing together bits of information and beginning to speculate and extrapolate what actually happened in the day. Until we can validate it from different sources and come to rely on it as fact. But that said, the fact is all prone to change as time goes by and new information is revealed. So have we established that there is, for you, the Master Mason, an opportunity to do your own translation, to do your own interpretation of events, where there is a lack of certainty, we can together acknowledge that there are different theories, different explanations about events, and different sources to validate those different theories. And as time goes by, we have the potential and the probability of knowing the facts as they occurred. And who knows, one of those theories that are out in front of us right now may well be the accurate series description of events. But still we have that gnawing appetite for the unknown. The encouragement to ask questions, to explore. And whether that there is no instruction that stops a Mason from stepping back or going off the reservation, as they say, as the term is, to study. Nobody says that it's necessarily a group study approach. In fact, there is evidence to suggest it's not. In the mind, when you're able to take certain events and certain things seriously, we find the emergence of the Masonic notion. That doesn't mean solemn. It means serious. There's elements about our lives and our development of character that are serious and require effort. The order of Shiva, this notion of the unknown, we've seen this in alchemists, and we've seen this in a little deeper. The analysis takes us a little deeper into an intellectual approach, an understanding of the intellect of masonry. The order of Chevalier Bénéficent de la Cité Sainte was founded by Saint Baptiste Willermoss. This is an entry in England restricted to a small number of the great priory of the Temple, Masonic Knights Templar. If the unknown superiors cannot be found, one had perhaps better make some. Only this time they could be better known to a few at least. What's the point, one might ask, of knowing an unknown superior? Surely then they would no longer be unknown superiors, and one may suppose that they would be quite so, not so superior anymore. It seems the knowable superiors might yet need some unknown superiors to back them up. In fringe Freemasonry, unknown superiors are not unknown. Trying to locate the lost unknown superiors would become a staple activity of forms of Freemasonry that developed on the continent in the middle to late 18th century, all with a distinctly hermetic and alchemical tinge. Though gold was, as ever, hard to come by. If you decided that your fraternity owes its spiritual cause to lost Rose Cross brothers, lost Knights Templar, or simply the lost word of Hiram of Biff, You were logically bound to suppose some kind of existence of unknown or at least invisible superiors. This logical trap would encase a great deal of Western esoteric thought down to the present day, where any number of self-proclaimed hierophants have claimed or still claim to receive their authority from otherworldly beings, or, since the era of alleged flying saucer beings, extraterrestrials. Extraterrestrials occupy all of the psychological aspects once reserved for august spirit entities and remote Himalayan Mahatmas, or great souls. This must show the influence of technological science as demonstrated at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's no accident that James Hilton called his highly successful novel about Westerners saved by the agency of Shangri-La, Lost Horizon. It was, of course, invisible. The plane of Western technology would have to crash before its survivors could see the alleged superior wisdom. Such seems to be an analogous hope of certain unspoken strands involved in the current global green movement. Man will always be the otherworldly being when he insists on reinventing himself as a god. As Kipling realized, we all share in the man who would be king. According to the theory, we may all aspire to be unknown superiors, that part of our being that is unknown to ourselves. Wouldn't it be stranger than fiction if all this strangeness had come about simply because Baron von Hund couldn't recognize Bonnie Prince Charlie or his stand-in when he saw him? But then again, perhaps von Hund was blindfolded, a useful tool when in the company of unknown superiors. The truth was lost in the Scotch mist. Oh, my. What icons would you display in your lodge? What icons? Then, hearing this, would it be the Buddha? Would it be the prophets? Would it be Alexander? Would it be Darwin or Newton? Or maybe Shakespeare? Or would it be Helen of Troy? That composite of beauty and being. Danger, the intoxication of beauty, the danger presents to men. What would the three icons be in your lodge that would represent, speak about your view of masonry? You just think about it for a moment. Icons that would be there and be presenting a message to those other members who had the bearing to understand you were sending a message, to understand that within the symbols around, a message is being conveyed, a system of belief which places upon us a choice of whether we subscribe to that belief or not. Meanwhile, the symbols that you present will wait benignly to speak in a way to the curious mind that walks through the door and realizes, like most of the listeners to Masonic Effects, just how much there is to learn and just how much is going on in the lodge. How many voices, how many stories, how much information is there around us? So if you had that task, what three icons would you, what three busts? Or would it be the sketch Michelangelo did of himself, or would it be a piece of his work representing the great master? Would it be a Borelli in translation of the, an interpretation of the gods, or would it be a bit of his work? Would it be a carving? Would it be a statue? You decide. What speaks to you and what conveys meaning? That's the, one of the most important parts of our order. And yes, if you choose to sleep through it all, there's not anybody else that's going to take you to school. That's something that as a man of mature means you need to do for yourself. The appetite for learning needs to be yours alone. It's been a pleasure having you here on The Sonic Effects. I hope you've enjoyed the program today. I hope you come back soon. Meanwhile, think about those acts of Masonic kindness. Think about the nature of your own character. How do you conduct yourself? Challenge yourself if you're set into a world that selectively filters out the negatives. If that's what you see as a unique expression of your existence, then rethink it. Because what you're doing is making a choice. And if you are making a choice, that means it's one amongst others. I'll send you on your way to the little Terrence Blanchard. If you're not a fan of Terrence Blanchard, at least give him a listen. Take care of yourselves in the meantime. Come on back. Thank you. Time has done to mystery what it does to all mysteries. Mystery becomes commonplace. In 1593, Carolus Clusius introduced tulips to Holland from Turkey. He planted a small garden to research possible medicinal benefits. Neighbors, seeing the colorful blossoms, broke into the yard to steal the unusually attractive flowers to sell. And the rest, as they say, is history. Over the next 7 decades, the supply-demand cycle saw overvaluation. A single bulb went for 2,500 florins. That's about $2,000 Canadian. And rare strains went for double that amount. They became so valuable, it was thought risky to plant them. Unplanted bulbs were put on display. As all speculation comes to an end, so too did the bulb market in 1637. When the market bubble popped, traders were making 60,000 florins a month. Until one day a trader failed to show up to pay for bulbs he had purchased. This was the mirror that brought the Dutch to realize a reality they had ignored. These were bulbs. Today we plant them, we buy them in little bags for a few dollars. Few buyers ever aware they are buying something once valued beyond reason. Time. We really don't know what it is. But today, we think it has something to do with time and space. Light particles, waves, curves, gravity, and us. The sun does rise in the morning, don't you know? Spinning at 53,000 kilometers an hour, it takes the Earth an entire day to circle into and away from the protons and neutrons, life-giving. Some of us may stand in awe at the magnificence of our universe and the fragile processes that produce life on this planet. Science still plunges into the mystery. Each answer leads to another question, another answer, another mystery. But we don't call it superstition. Superstition is phenomena that occur when we are governed by perception. Study the arts and sciences. Oh, it's the instruction of the master, to the master nature, isn't it? Thank you.